Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Every time a baby is born, you brace for it now. The new parent's Facebook feed seems to explode with adorable photos, well wishes, and pithy observations on early childhood. Sounds like fun. But research has shown that when new mothers become too focused on those posts, they are more likely to experience stress and unhappiness. Human sciences and psychology professor at the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy at Ohio State University, Sarah Shoppy Sullivan, recently wrote about the trend for TheConversation.com. Her article is entitled, Why Facebook May Fuel New Mothers' Insecurity. Sarah Shoppy Sullivan joins us now. Welcome back.
Hi. Thank you.
What first got you interested in taking a closer look at how social media affects parents?
Well, it was actually a couple of things. One of my graduate students at Ohio State decided that he wanted to study new parents' use of social networking sites. And we were just launching a big study of couples who were expecting their first baby. These are couples from Columbus and the surrounding area. And we were planning to follow them over that transition into parenthood. And so we created a survey together to give to the parents when their babies were 9 months old that asked them to think back in the early months of parenthood and think about how often and how the ways in which they use Facebook and other social networking sites.
New parents have always worried about comparisons, and new mothers especially have always dealt with, you know, childbirth. And, you know, there's a lot of different things going on. There's a lot of physiological things going on. There's a lot of just sleep deprivation going on. There's a lot of stuff going on that can create anxiety and unhappiness. You say that the comparison to other mothers on Facebook contributes to this then that can cause stress. How does that work?
Sure. Well, there are kind of two parts to what we found in our study. The first part was that certain mothers are more prone to greater Facebook activity than other mothers.
So just certain people.
Yeah. So it was some mothers who are very concerned, especially concerned with what other people think about their parenting. They want confirmation that they're good mothers, that they're doing a good job. And also those that tend to think very perfectionistically about parenthood, like they think other people really expect them to be perfect mothers. And so these were mothers who were more likely to spend more time on Facebook and to be more reactive to people's responses to pictures that they posted of their babies. So these were mothers who said that when their baby pictures got a lot of likes, they felt better, like it actually seemed to affect how they felt. And when they got fewer likes or recognitions, they kind of felt disappointed. So there were certain mothers this seemed to be an issue for. And then the second part of that is those mothers' greater activity on Facebook was linked to elevated depressive symptoms in the first 9 months of parenthood.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about the impact of social media on new parents, especially new mothers, and how they feel about themselves, how they feel about mothering. My guest is Sarah Shoppy Sullivan. She's a professor of human sciences and psychology and a faculty associate of the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy at Ohio State. If you know what we're talking about, if you're one of those people, maybe you avoid Facebook for this very reason. Give us a call and tell us about your experience. Calling all new mothers, what do you think about the impact of social media, especially Facebook, on the experience? 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Perhaps you're married to one of these mothers and you have some insights about this. We'd like to hear from you too. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Your study showed that new parents actually post more on Facebook than they did before, after their child was born, than they did before their child was born. What do we know about that? Is that because it's just the thing to do nowadays?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that there are a lot of good reasons for it, too. I mean, parents are excited. And like you pointed out, you know, new parents and new mothers, perhaps in particular, have always wanted to share, you know, photos of their baby. Facebook and other social networking sites just make it so easy to do that. And so, I think that's why we saw an increase. It's just that, you know, And people's Facebook friends, you know, it varies, but a certain portion of them tend to be friends, you know, that they know well, and also family members. And certainly, as many people live far away from family or further away than perhaps in times past, it's an easy way to share, you know, the the experience of being a parent.
One of the things, though, about social media is you tend to experience it isolated.
Right.
You're alone when you're reading those posts or looking for those thumbs up or little heart things.
Right. I think that is a complicating factor as well. So whereas, you know, you could be sharing actual pictures with, you know, friends at lunch or something like that. If you're sharing photos online, you tend to be by yourself. And so I think in that way, these things can get into your head in a way that maybe it wouldn't happen if they were part of real face-to-face social interactions.
How mostly I see just pictures and, like I said, funny observations a lot of times.
Sure.
I can think of a few people in particular. I've really enjoyed their observations, and they take their baby pictures and they kind of put words in their baby's mouths. And that's funny. Mm-hmm. But I also sometimes wonder that all of a sudden there's a big drop off. Don't hear from her for a while because I figured the baby started, you know, staying up at night and that kind of a
sure,
thing.
Sure.
Something's changed. They started talking back.
Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, and this isn't universal again, but another thing that others have observed, other researchers who've studied this phenomenon, is that a lot of what parents tend to post on social networking sites about their children is either really funny or really cute, or, you know, they're not necessarily posting about the mundane everyday drudgery that is a lot of taking care of a baby, you know? I mean, occasionally maybe people post something really dramatic, like about a diaper blowout or something, you know, something mm-hmm. to get some laughs. But it's these extremes. And so that also creates kind of an artificial picture of what parenthood is really like.
Toby in Delaware, you're on the air. Hi, Toby. Hello, Toby.
Hi, Toby. This is Toby. I'm sorry. I'm from Delaware. That's why you kind of threw me there.
Yeah.
I had two questions here, or I had a quick question. Did you look at, like, parents that did not put anything about Facebook or anything about their kids on Facebook? And was this a Facebook issue with mothers, or was this something that maybe Facebook exacerbated?
Yeah, exacerbated. And was there a control group? I mean, did you compare and contrast? Sarah Shapi Sullivan.
Yeah, no, there was no explicit control group in this study. We started collecting the data in 2008. So it's been, you know, 9 years and probably 7 years since we actually surveyed about Facebook use. We also at that time asked about MySpace as well, but nobody was using that anymore. So mm-hmm. we didn't use those data. But we didn't include things like Instagram or, you know, Twitter and so forth. So you have to keep that in mind. There were some parents who didn't do any social networking, but it was the minority. And in terms of the link between greater Facebook activity in new moms and depressive symptoms, we did control for baseline depressive symptoms. So it did seem to be associated with an increase in depressive symptoms in the early months of parenthood. Not just mothers who were more depressed to begin with were the ones who were doing more Facebook activity.
So, Toby, I understand you're a new parent.
Yes, we adopted a little bit 3 days old about 8 months ago now.
You adopted, okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, and we were very blessed in how it all came together and all that kind of stuff. And it was amazing to us, the response, because we essentially got a call at 11:30 at night saying, hey, we got a baby. We're on a plane the next day. So literally none of our friends knew this was happening.
Uh-huh.
And when we were out in L.A., it was just overpowering because it was such a wonderful way of us staying in touch, as we were living in Los Angeles at a day's end for 2.5 weeks,
mm-hmm.
to feel like the people back here had a way to stay in touch. And I was one of those dads that said, no, my kid is not going to be on Facebook. We're doing no pictures. We're not promoting this because, you know,
yeah,
I felt like we were putting, you know, my job, I do a lot of promotion and stuff. I do a lot of advertising on Facebook and stuff like that. And I'm like, I really don't want to do that. And within 10 minutes of us having this little baby in our hands, I think the first Facebook picture went up. So I kind of was wondering.
I'm losing you, Toby. I'm losing you. I just lost you on that.
Sorry. I wasn't a good practice what I preach kind of person.
Yeah, yeah. Do you regret it now? I mean, are you feeling any of the anxiety, or is your spouse feeling any of the anxiety that Sarah's talking about?
I think there was a stage where, you know, I don't regret it at all because of it allowed people, because our journey was a little different where we literally had 9 months thrown into 24 to 8 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the journey was not, I don't regret at all how we handled it. There was a spot where, you know, she wasn't sleeping at all. And so I have been primary caregiver during the day, and then my wife was doing to help and take care of her at night. And the way it was working out, we were both extremely sleep deprived. And then we had a few people make comments on, you know, there's a handful of those snide remarks about, oh, well, you did that for your baby.
Yeah.
And when it wasn't necessarily what was said, it wasn't how, it was the timing in response to how we were feeling at that moment.
Yeah.
That all of a sudden it's like, oh my gosh, am I a horrible parent? What did I do wrong? And then all of a sudden then you start, you know, you stay, but it also was the reassuring coming back from the community as well that kept us from going off the deep end.
Yeah.
And suddenly, you know, taking our daughter and moving back to Eastern Knox County and putting her in, you know, going to an Amish community and never having any communication or such with anybody. But you know, it was the handful of people that kind of went off the deep end on us that made us doubt stuff, but we're both, you know, it's a unique, a little bit more unique in that we both were not there. I mean,
right. Well, you know what? I think, Toby, you bring up, Toby, a couple of things. You bring up something I want to get at. I want to say congratulations to you and your wife on your new parenthood and good luck. But I also want to follow up on what Toby said, Sarah, because people there is a judgy thing going on Facebook.
Yeah.
That people feel somehow free to tell people how to parent.
Yeah, that's something I've become more interested in. We didn't ask about that explicitly in our survey, the extent to which parents and particularly new mothers feel judged. But I think that is part of it. And I think when you post something, you are putting yourself out there. And, you know, like I said, this might be true of some parents more than others, but you're kind of hoping for a positive reaction, right? And if you don't get as much of a positive reaction if you want, or if you get some negative reactions, you know, it doesn't have to happen frequently in order to really kind of think of, like, you know, burst your balloon or have a effect on your confidence, you know. And I think new parents are just both fathers as well as mothers are just vulnerable.
They're sleep deprived, as
Toby
pointed out.
You're in a stressed state, and so these
normal,
things can affect you, you know, and you know, likely not in a major way or in a permanent way, but it's a vulnerable time.
Yeah. Toby, once again, congratulations and thanks for that call. We appreciate it. As a mother, Sarah, did this study change your posting behavior at all?
I think yes, because I mean, to be honest, so I resisted for a while joining Facebook, and I think I joined in 2008. My daughter, I have a daughter, she's 11 now, but she was 2 at the time. And I found myself doing a lot of these same things. And then I would look to see, you know, oh, who looked at her picture and who liked it. And so this is, you know, they say research is me search, I guess. There's a little bit of me in this study because I was interested in that. Now that what I think is interesting, too, is now that my daughter is older and she's aware that, you know, mom might post something on Facebook and she doesn't want me to. And there's some new research coming out that as children get older, that they, you know, they don't want you to, as the parent, to control their social media presence entirely. So it's very interesting.
Well, kids have different feelings about whenever you tell a story about them.
Of course.
And when you, even if you do it in just mixed company over dinner with friends.
Right.
Then next thing you know, you're doing it, you know, particularly in my case, to thousands of people, and it's just not going to work.
Yeah. No,
I never even tried.
Because it takes away their autonomy in terms of determining what, you know, is out there about them.
And some of the benefits, there are benefits, and Toby mentioned those too as well.
Yes. What we found is that when new mothers, a greater portion of their or proportion of their Facebook friends were actually close friends that they saw in person as well and family members, that actually that was associated with greater well-being. So I think that one option I know parents do sometimes is create a family group on Facebook, you know, where they post more stuff about their kids than they do in general. And so that might be something that could be potentially useful if you have supportive, of course, if you have supportive family and close friends, right?
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, Sarah Shappi Sullivan, thanks for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Sure. Thank you.
Sarah Shappi Sullivan is professor of human sciences and psychology and a faculty associate of the Crane Center for Early Childhood Research and Policy at Ohio State. More Wellness Wednesday coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. Modern medicine doesn't have all the answers. Author and journalist Susanna Meadows learned that the hard way when her young son was diagnosed with a chronic joint disease. Traditional medicine didn't help, so Meadows turned to alternatives and found her own answers in a change of diet for her child. Meadows' new book chronicles that story and those of other families that sought unconventional treatments. The book is entitled The Other Side of Impossible, Ordinary People Who Faced Daunting Medical Challenges and Refused to Give Up. Welcome to the show, Susanna Meadows.
Thanks, Ann. I'm so happy to be here. I used to live in Pepper Pike, so it's like coming home.
Oh, all right. Up there in northern Ohio.
Exactly.
Susanna, your son Shepherd was diagnosed with juvenile idiopathic arthritis. Can you give us a brief description of the symptoms, you know, what you're dealing with and what the medicine that was originally prescribed did?
Well, JIA causes painful swelling in the joints and can lead to disability, stunted growth, and in rare cases, blindness. And in my son Shepherd's case, within a month of starting from when we first noticed that he was limping, within a month he was having trouble getting out of bed because he was in so much pain. So we started him on medication. First it was naproxen, which is, as you may know, is related to ibuprofen. Mm-hmm. But then when that didn't do much, we started him on methotrexate, which is an immune suppressant. And that came with very worrying risks down the road, increased risk of lymphoma, although not a big one, but very troubling for me. And at the same time, he felt sick. He would lie on the couch for a couple of days after taking his pills once a week. And I could not accept that that's how it was going to be for him.
Was it helping?
It was helping only a little bit. And we were looking at having to increase his dose of the methotrexate. And that was just terrifying to me. I couldn't accept a life for him where he felt sick. So that's when I started wondering, well, what else can we do here?
How did your physician respond?
He was actually great. We went in to him and said, look, we heard from another mother whose child had JIA. We heard that she tried these diet changes and had luck. And he was open to the conversation, and he said, look, as long as you stay on the medication, I'm not against you're trying this other protocol. And so that's what we did. We stayed on the medication because we didn't want to take any risks. And we tried this other protocol. And then within 6 weeks, I was in the habit at that point of going in to help Shepherd out of bed in the morning. And within 6 weeks, he got up on his own and said, Mommy, my knees don't hurt anymore. And then from that point on, it took a couple months and the arthritis left his body and we were able to come off all the medication. And he's been off now for 4 years.
Well, let me ask you, how did your physician respond to that?
I asked him about it. He said, it was absolutely possible from where he sat that the diet change had an effect. And I think that he also came to believe that Shepherd probably had the two foods we took Shepherd off were gluten and dairy, and our doctor said, it's probably true that he has some kind of gluten sensitivity. But he also said, look, he stayed on the medication, so we don't know for sure what it was that made him better. Maybe the medication kicked in late. But the fact is, he was never expected to be able to come off medication.
Right. I was going to ask you that. Okay.
Yeah. We were told he'd be struggling with the arthritis for life. And because of the specific kind he had where more than five joints were affected, kids just, they tend not to outgrow it. So it was very unlikely that he was able to recover.
So why the reaction that maybe the medication did something different in this case than it ever has done before versus wow, maybe I start prescribing a different diet for my patients.
I know. It's a funny question. I've asked so many different doctors now at this point, now that I've researched the book, where I said, look, where doctors will talk about patients who improve when they take gluten out of their diet. And I've asked so many people, well, then do you then recommend that to other patients? And they say no. And it's really hard to understand. One doctor explained it to me this way. He said, look, you know, we don't know who's going to benefit.
I'm sorry, but Susanna, the voice sounds far away.
Oh, I'm sorry.
There
you
go.
Is that better?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
This one celiac disease researcher in Boston, who's at Mass General, said, look, we don't know who's going to benefit. And this is somebody who says he sees children recover from arthritis when they take gluten out of their diet often. And he was one of the people who said, it doesn't mean I recommend it to other families. And he said, we just, you know, maybe 10, 15, 20% of people will recover. And I said, well, that's the difference between you and me, because as a mom, I'll take those odds. I mean, there are no risks involved in trying this. And if it's a 1 in 5 chance that he can get better, I'll take those. And it's very interesting. He said, oh, wait a minute. I was talking to you as a scientist, but as a father, then absolutely I would experiment. So it's what I've come to understand is that there are certain things that doctors are comfortable with, and they're only going to recommend what is backed by overwhelming clinical evidence. Well, we don't have that in this case. And so it's up to us to talk to our doctors about risk, but also to know that there might be something that's outside of their expertise that can help.
How do you feel about doctors only prescribing? Let me ask you this a little bit differently. How do you feel about the fact that research only studies medicines and not lifestyle?
I think it's a real loss because the fact is we don't know enough about disease to be able to say, oh, yes, the answer is definitely going to be coming from a pharmaceutical. To me, it's ridiculous that we are not looking at everything. And the fact is, I'm sure you're aware of all this microbiome research that's coming out, and mm-hmm. the microbiome being the population of bacteria that lives in our bodies, and that having a healthy population is a huge factor in our health. It's tied into all different processes in our body. And when we don't have a healthy population, that situation is associated with all different kinds of diseases, including arthritis, including allergies, asthma. The list goes on. And what is the one thing that has a major impact on our bacteria population? It's what we eat. And so the fact that we have this potential answer, and it does not, I mean, actually, I do believe that microbiome research is getting a lot of funding, mm-hmm. but diet research does not, and that's for the obvious reason that it's not something that can be patented and profited from. And so from my perspective, it's just crazy to ignore this possible answer. And it's on, I mean, this is why we have government research. It's why we have private funded research, because the answers might not be something that we can sell.
But even government funded research is not necessarily focused on it.
No, but it at least, and in fact, with this, there's this, you know, the new budget proposal, the National yeah. Institutes of Health budget we saw
pretty much zeroes it out.
Is slashed. Yeah. So, and you're absolutely right. There's simply not a focus on nutrition as a possible answer for these diseases. But maybe that will change once we learn more about the microbiome.
I'm talking with Susanna Meadows, author of the book, The Other Side of Impossible, Ordinary People Who Faced Daunting Medical Challenges and Refused to Give Up. How did you find the stories of the other families that you included in your book? Can you tell us a little bit about some of those?
Oh, sure. You know, whenever I'm working on a story, this is what seems to happen, is you're talking to people and then you hear things and people mention stories. And it was when I first wrote about my son in the New York Times Magazine that I was talking to different researchers because I wanted to see, gosh, is there any science that can explain why diet might have helped them? And by the way, there was. Mm-hmm. It's not that there is no science. There actually are quite a few studies that suggest diet can help autoimmune arthritis. But
you're not going to hear about it from your doctor is the rub.
Exactly. I mean, we had one doctor tell us diet, you know, emphatically, diet does not work. And so when I then found, you know, went and found, there's lots of research actually out of Scandinavia. And when you find these studies, it was just sort of amazing to me. I thought, well, how do we not know this stuff?
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, when I was talking to researchers and doctors, they told me things. One researcher at NIH said, you know what, you should talk to my sister-in-law. She's gone through something like you've gone through, and I think you would have a lot to talk about. This woman, then I reached out to, and she'd been struggling for years to help her daughter who had autistic traits and intractable epilepsy. And she then became part of the book. And in my conversations with her, she said, hey, have you ever heard of this woman, Terry Walls? Terry Walls is this doctor with MS who was using a wheelchair, changed her diet radically, and is now riding a bike. And so they just sort of, they all kind of, one led to another. And it became clear to me that there was a much bigger story going on, that people are doing this because they're desperate and medicine does not always have the answers.
And in fact, can often make you sicker.
Well, sure. And I think that, I think certainly for us, the side effects, you know, I may never have gone down this road had Shepherd felt fine on the medicine and responded well to it. But we forget sometimes that drugs just are not a magic bullet, always.
Any common denominators, as far as their approach to life when it came to these families?
Well, I was very interested in that question while I was working on the book. I wanted to understand what is it about a person that makes her think that she can find the answer when no one else has? And this is not science, but everybody that I spoke to, everybody who I ended up profiling in the book, except for one, had overcome very difficult circumstances as children. And it turns out that there's some science that supports that idea that if you have overcome something at time one, then the next time you're faced with a challenge, you will be less helpless. I mean, it's also common sense, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that stood out to me. But I thought it was striking that most of the people I was writing about had that early experience.
What about people who are like that and they're willing to try other things, but their physicians are adamantly against it? And I'm sure there must be examples out there of people who were accused of being negligent.
Right. Well, I think, I mean, for me, it took me a while to... I think it's really hard to question your doctor because the doctor, certainly in my case, knows more about disease than I ever will and is an expert on this thing that your child has. And so it's very hard to get to a point of questioning that and realizing, there might be something he doesn't know. There might be something outside of his expertise. And I think you have to take charge and have confidence. I think always you're going to want to talk it over with your doctor and make sure you're not taking risks. But in the end, it's, you know, at least in our case, we felt that, okay, as long as we're not taking risks, then we can do this. But it's a hard thing to do. And there's a lot of comfort to be had in just following doctor's advice. And so I can understand when people don't want to go off-road.
Are there any insurance implications going forward with that kind of a thing?
Well, none of the, I mean, so all of the things that we've been talking about today are pre-existing conditions,
mm-hmm.
right? And under the proposed repeal of Obamacare, and we don't know what will happen when the Senate takes it up, but the House bill allows states to apply for waivers that would allow insurers in those states to charge people more money for pre-existing conditions. And so we've heard people go to these town halls and say, how am I going to take care of my family, my child with allergies, for example. Mm-hmm. And so to me, what is important about the stories in my book is that these are potential therapies for people that are outside of healthcare. And in fact, I write about a woman who's developed a therapy for food allergies, and she's had tremendous anecdotal success. Boston Children's Hospital is now studying her protocol because so many children are recovering from their allergies, which is unheard of. But so this, to me, these stories and what these people are figuring out, we need to study what they're doing. We need more information. We need to know if what they're doing can help other people. But at the same time, they offer hope that for panicked families who may face increased healthcare costs, you know, one potential option is recovery. I mean, we don't have any in our family. We're not paying for any drugs anymore. So it's worth thinking about in this climate that there may be options for people outside of healthcare.
Susanna Meadows, thanks a lot for your time today. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Anne. I'm really, really glad to be here.
Susanna Meadows is the author of the new book entitled The Other Side of Impossible, Ordinary People Who Faced Daunting Medical Challenges and Refused to Give Up. More Wellness Wednesdays coming up on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. When a patient gets a serious medical diagnosis, it can be confusing and scary. Patients are expected to deal with complex terms, decide on treatment options, and consider what will be covered by health insurance, all while dealing with a health issue. The issues are getting more complex at the same time that physicians and nurses seem to have less time to spend one-on-one with each patient. A new specialist is emerging to help with that. It's called the Patient Advocate. Joining us now is Patient Advocate and owner of Guided Patient Services, Dr. Annette Tikoris. Welcome to the show.
Oh, hello. It's good to be here.
You're only one in the state of Ohio, as far as you know.
I do know there's another in northeastern Ohio.
Okay.
But for central Ohio, as far as I know, just me.
Why so few?
It's a new entity. I think back in the 90s, large hospital facilities were instituting navigators.
Yeah.
Especially in the areas of oncology, just to help facilitate treatment and to answer questions for patients and to keep them somewhat engaged and empowered. And then I think that as it's become more and more complex, people have reached out to family and loved ones to kind of act as that role of advocate.
Like, go with me to my doctor's appointments kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Particularly with serious illness, particularly with oncology, it's gotten really complicated.
That's right.
In a good way when it comes to treating, but in a bad way when it comes to understanding.
Right, because the options are just so diverse and so complex, and the words are impossible to pronounce, the treatments likewise. And people want the best of care. They want all of the options available to them to be explained to them, but then they need to do that all very quickly.
You know, having to hire somebody like you to do this rubs some people the wrong way. It's extra money and insurance doesn't cover it.
Right. And it's something that I deal with. I field many calls during the week of people who cannot afford services or to pay to have this done. And I often do get those conversations, you know, why am I paying to do what healthcare is supposed to do for me? And in many cases it does, but there are those exceptions and those are the calls that I receive.
You are a physician, a licensed physician.
I am.
What made you take this change?
I took some time off when I raised my children, and in filling that time, this was what I found I was doing, whether it was by choice or not.
Just friends calling you for help?
friends and family. I have an upcoming appointment, or this is what the doctor said, or this is the new prescription I've been written for. These are my symptoms. What do you think? So I was finding I was doing this, and then I had a series of friends who had breast cancer, many within a 1 year period of time, and was down here in Columbus at that time assisting, and found that there was a need. There was an overwhelming need, and knew that when I reentered medicine, it was going to be in a different capacity. And this was a perfect fit.
Do most, I mean, there's only one other patient advocate that you know of in the state. There's a couple hundred across the country. What are their backgrounds? Do you talk to each other? And it, you know, who do they tend to be? People like you, a physician, or what?
No, I it's very diverse. I have had quite a bit of contact over the last, I'd say, 3 to 4 years. Those that I tend to have the most in common with that we seek each other out professionally would be nurses. A couple other physicians are doing this as well. Social workers do this. I, on occasion, have utilized someone who is more in the financial insurance realm. Maybe they were a biller or a coder for a physician. That is not my area of expertise. I stay out of that lane. So sometimes I will refer to them or consult them regarding questions I have.
Are there standards of care when it comes to being an advocate like this, a patient advocate like this?
Today, no. As of the date today, there is a task force that has been put together by the national agencies and memberships for advocates that are putting together a certification exam, and it will then be required to pass that exam, to have some credentialing. So moving forward, when someone says they are a credentialed or accredited or certified advocate, it actually has some bearing and some meaning that is consistent across the board.
When you look at a future in healthcare, how do you envision this role actually working in the most efficient, effective way?
Well, I have a dream of how that looks. And for me, I've had the opportunity to be in hospitals working side by side with my colleagues, physicians, but in a different capacity. And I think the more exposure that the healthcare system has to this, the more that everyone will realize it's such a win-win-win
situation. Just do it themselves?
Not necessarily do it themselves, but to maybe have to broaden their support staff in their offices to accommodate the needs. Right now, resources are so tight in a physician's office with all of the charting and medical record and phone calls, and now physicians are being asked to email and text, and I can't imagine how long the days have become, that if some of those tasks could be diverted to other experienced personnel, I think they would find their job would be easier, and the patients would be, in some cases, better satisfied.
You said a win-win. Win-win for who? Who are the vested interests in that equation?
For a patient, they now are getting maybe that explanation 2, 3, 4 times that may be needed. Someone's slowing the situation down. Someone's willing to go beyond that office appointment for additional questions they have later, and to be able to field those questions, take those calls, almost translate what just happened. For a physician, there's a benefit there. I've had multiple opportunities where I've been in a hospital and a physician has roughly 1 to 3 minutes to round on a hospital patient. And they may do that twice a day, but it's very brief. And patients have compiled a list of questions.
Because they're told to.
Yeah, be ready, be prepared. Mm-hmm. And they have to advocate on their behalf. And sometimes that's very, very difficult, especially with the elderly population. When you sense and they read people's body language, if you sense your physician is at the end of the bed with a hand on the door and you've got your list of 4 questions, it's kind of an intimidating situation. So I think that if physicians would then allow a knowledgeable person, whether it be a patient advocate or a family member who is knowledgeable, to be able to speak for that individual and to enter into that kind of relationship, it really pays off. Also in the hospital, there are so many physicians coming in and out. The communication tends to not be the best always. And again, an advocate can step in and kind of bring all those pieces together and make certain they're working collaboratively.
Who should be providing that, though? You said that, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, and who should pay for it? It's a person. It's a human being mm-hmm. making, doing this job. Mm-hmm. Should it be covered by insurance, do you think?
I don't think that it should be something that an individual is slated with paying for. Where those funds and where those resources are going to come from, I don't see. I don't see how that will, where that's going to come from mm-hmm. to involve insurance in one more capacity of healthcare. I'm not sure that's the route to go. I don't have it. To be honest, I don't have an answer, but we need some.
And I'm just wondering who's harmed most by all of this will tend to be somebody who doesn't have a lot of disposable income.
Exactly. Exactly.
They're going to tend to come from less education background, mm-hmm. less time, more stress, mm-hmm. more toxic stress, that mm-hmm. kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm. But I have many clients who are on the other end of the spectrum, and to be in the healthcare system today is...
by definition, toxic stress.
I didn't say that. You did. Unless you have a medical degree, I'm not really sure how you would navigate today's healthcare. There are so many people coming in and out of an office in a room. You're not certain what role each person plays. The orderly looks the same as the physician, looks the same as the specialist or the person who's going to wheel you down to radiology. And so people, I think, tend to just sort of lay back and let whatever's supposed to happen happen and assume that the best of care will be provided to them. And in most cases, I do believe that it is. But there are lots of opportunities to step in and make certain.
How well or how could this be mitigated at the educational level when it comes to medical professionals, physicians, nurses, nurse practitioners, all that kind of stuff?
Well, I've had several people reach out to me there for a time being. I would say maybe 5 years ago, there were a lot of institutions that were affiliated with medical schools that were trying to incorporate a certification coursework. And they were actually trying to put some of the medical students through at least some of the coursework so that they were aware of it. They could do it on their patient's behalf or know that it was a vital part to include in their practice. A lot of those have gone by the wayside. And what popped up in place is a lot of online certification exams to kind of, you know, brush over and give some very superficial knowledge to people. I know that I've heard, you know, OU and some of the other medical schools who are trying to do a more patient-centered education are very open-minded to reaching out that, you know, we realize that, you know, That thing, it's going to take a village. It's going to take a village to really, in healthcare now, to provide for a patient. I think it's going to take more than the physician.
Are there any liability issues that someone like you has to grapple with? Are you insured?
I am. I carry professional liability insurance and am absolutely, positively very clear with all of my clients and is all my information. I do not provide services. I don't treat patients. I don't provide any kind of diagnostic assistance. Or
is what you do give advice? Do you put it that way, or how do you describe what you do in the simplest terms?
I try not to use the word advice because mm-hmm. that's what they should be getting from their physician. I translate. I incorporate. I digest it. I process it for them. I lay it out in a way that makes sense to them and ensure that they truly understand so that they're empowered enough to make. I don't make their decisions. I empower them to make decisions for themselves. But they can keep coming back. But I still don't, you know, they can say, I still don't understand that. I want some more information. Are you sure there's nothing else that I could be doing? You know, some of my clients are just that. I'm very comfortable with my physicians, but I want to make certain that there's nothing else out there that I should be looking into. And in that case, I'm tasked with doing the research to see what else might be available.
Finding another opinion, that kind of a thing. Because we were just talking to Susanna Meadows, the author of that book, The Other Side of Impossible, Ordinary People Who Face Daunting Medical Challenges and Refuse to Give Up. And I would think there's a role there in terms of helping people who are not getting satisfaction from the traditional community and helping them find other options.
I can, you know, assist them in finding other options, or sometimes the first place I start and the one that makes the most sense is to just try and address the current help and healthcare that they're receiving. You know, does the provider just need to slow down and listen? Does the patient really get their points across, and have they made their case clear to the physician? So many times, I think in almost all times, the circumstances show that communication could be improved. And so I try and go in first and improve the communication with what's already in place, get a good feel that what's in place does need to be tweaked or changed or improved. Often that fixes a vast number of the concerns that a client has.
Who often hires you? Is it the person who is sick, who's getting the medical treatment themselves, or sometimes is it their family members?
Both.
Okay.
And I'm set up to do it in both ways. I think the one caveat, though, if a family member would approach me about caring for a spouse or for a parent, provided that the parent is of sound mind, everything needs to be signed for and agreed to by that parent. I can't, just like a physician, they can't step in and start to take over for the individual. However, in the circumstances where medical power of attorney has been executed, then I start to work with the medical power of attorney, but of course insist upon seeing that the documentation is up to date and appropriate.
I would imagine an aging population boom that we're in now is going to have a lot of call for this sort of thing, whether it's somebody helping people who are hard of hearing and that kind of thing deal with medical issues.
Yes, I think with our aging population, a lot of them, their plan that they had in place was, I'll be there for you, you'll be there for me. And so I think those who are widowed, those who maybe were divorced earlier in life or perhaps never married, and the coined term, and I don't know if it's been on your show before, is an elder orphan. And that term is being used a lot.
It has no children.
Have no children. They either have no siblings, or in any of those cases, if they have one or some of that family available, but they're estranged from them, that still essentially makes you an orphan. So these people know if they've kind of slowed down and taken time to think about it, that they're facing or the risk of facing a healthcare crisis on their own. And that's a very scary place to be. And I hear that a lot. I've planned for my funeral. I've planned for this. I've planned for that. But if the rescue ever takes me to the hospital, there's no one on the other end, and there's no one I can call, and there's no one who's going to show up. And that's a very, very disheartening thought to have day in and day out.
Have you ever been called by a physician to step in?
No, I'd love to. I'd love to.
Where they understand what their limitations are and say, you know, I need help.
I think we're headed there. And, you know, people have asked me that multiple times. I've had absolutely nothing but positive reception by the medical field. I still, again, consider myself a colleague and have the utmost respect. But we each can play a role. And I think once they see it in action and see how not taking Mrs. Jones's 20th call that week and then the one from her son and the one from her daughter, and she still didn't fill the prescription. But let me have a shot at it. You know, let her have a relationship with me. Let me have the opportunity for her to feel as though it's slowed down and her questions are addressed and explained in a way in which she can understand, and it empowers her. So then she does what the healthcare field wants her to do, and she's healthier and benefits.
Do you get involved at the palliative care hospice level too?
Again, I think it's a great fit and it's a great place. Thus far, only because I've had clients come to me who are at that stage.
Right. Okay. Well, Dr. Annette Tacoris, thank you so much for joining us. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
Dr. Annette Tacoris, she's the owner and advocate at Guided Patient Services, Inc. She's the only one in Central Ohio, for sure, only one of two in Ohio. We'll have a link to her website on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. That's it for Wellness Wednesday today. Thanks a lot for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.